Welcome to another episode of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. Today is Monday, June 27th, 2022. I'm your host, Audrey Sternberg. Dr. Sunil D. Kamath of the Cleveland Clinic Towsing Cancer Institute in Cleveland, Ohio, spoke with the editorial team of the journal Oncology about his published manuscript titled Association of Financial Conflicts of Interest with Academic Productivity Among Junior Faculty in Hematology and Oncology. Sunil and his colleagues set out to determine how financial conflicts of interest could be used as a surrogate for the trajectory of early career oncologists and junior faculty at academic institutions. He touched on how understanding relationships between clinicians and industry is important for both drug development as well as early academic productivity of individual investigators.
So, Dr. Kamath, thank you so much for taking some time to speak with me on the podcast about your research. I really appreciate it.
Of course, yeah. Thanks for having me.
So I just wanted to start at the top. Before we get really into the work, could you talk a little bit about what your motivation was behind pursuing this paper that focuses on conflict of interest and really what you and your colleagues wanted to show with this piece?
Yeah, so it really started in fellowship for me, actually, where I think as you progress through your training, you start to get more and more familiar with pharma and industry interactions and how that leads to, you know, collaborations for research and things like that. And it sort of struck me that, as I think a lot of fellowships are, they're very protective of fellows in terms of being exposed to industry and pharma. It's sort of treated as a taboo kind of thing. You know, you're really not sure whether you really should be going to that dinner or talking to this person or what have you. And as I started to progress further, I sensed that conflict there where it's, you know, it's clear that we need to have these relationships in order to further science. And it's clear to me that people who do have a lot of interactions and collaborations with industry were very successful, developed a lot of, you know, important drugs and therapies for our patients. So it's clear that, you know, that relationship needs to be there, but there was also some sort of taboo around it. And so I think we wanted to explore, you know, really where there's some positive benefits, because at the time, you know, and in the last few years, really, it seems like everything around COIs has been, you know, has been a negative thing, you know, that people are making the wrong decisions or choosing the wrong drugs simply because, you know, they're influenced by company X or Y. But it occurred to me that, you know, there's probably some positive to it. I think that needs to be highlighted more.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective there. And so this is going to sound like a really basic question for you, so bear with me. But could you kind of just talk about what exactly conflicts of interest are and really what kind of impact they can have on hematology, oncology, and the overall drug development process?
That's a great question. I think it's a difficult thing to define. I mean, I think the way I would look at it, I think, is, you know, any sort of relationship where there may be sort of an undue influence on a decision you might make. You know, for us in hematology oncology, I think that's where, you know, people from a certain company might sort of influence a practitioner, an oncologist or hematologist, to have, you know, maybe an excessively positive view of a particular drug or therapy, and that might lead them to use that therapy more often when others may actually be better options for their patients.
Right. And so let's just really dive into this work now. Starting at the top, could you talk about what your hypothesis was and really what method you utilized to test this and what you saw with that population?
Yeah, so our hypothesis was, you know, another thing that we found was that, and we've experienced ourselves personally, is that junior investigators in particular really struggle as far as getting more traditional forms of funding from federal grants, Department of Defense grants, et cetera. Many times those big funding mechanisms tend to go to, you know, more senior and established investigators. And so it seems that having funding from industry was a great way to sort of start your career. And so that's why we sort of honed in on junior investigators. And we wanted to focus on people that were at, you know, some of the household name institutions, you know, the top 10 US News type hospitals and universities. And our hypothesis was that, you know, those who had more relationships with industry And the way we chose to measure that was sort of more dollars that were reported to the Sunshine Act, was one of the main measures. And then also higher numbers of conflicts of interest reported either to professional societies or reported into recent publications. We have hypothesized that those people would really have, more publications and then a higher impact of those publications. And the way we measured that was something called the H index, which it's a little difficult to describe, but I'll try to do my best. The way that we think about that is it's, so if you think about H as a number, H would be the number of papers that a certain investigator has published that have been cited H times. If you would have eight papers that were cited eight times, then you would have an H index of eight, is the best way to think about that. And the idea is really to measure both volume and also impact of the publications you have. And so we hypothesize, that both sort of the number of publications and these high impact publications would go up as more conflicts of interest were present.
Right. I mean, that was a pretty thorough explanation of it. And I will say, if a listener, doesn't get it from there, they're just gonna have to go back to the journal and read the article to get that full description of it. But so back to the paper here, you and your colleagues conclude that these financial conflicts of interest increased with the number of years of experience since completing a fellowship. Could you expand on that and really what the results were that led to this ultimate conclusion?
Yeah, so we found, as we would expect, so we separated the population we looked at by the year that they graduated fellowship. And we did sort of the most recent 3 years, 3 years before that, 3 years before, and then kind of everybody before. I believe it was 2012 was sort of the earliest group that we did. And what we found was that, so for the group that was closest to fellowship graduation, or actually, sorry, it was 2 year groups that we ended up doing. The ones that graduated in 2017 and 2018 had very few conflicts of interest at that point. But as we followed, people that were more senior, those who graduated 2015, 2016, 2013, 2014, and so on, we found that, the number of people who had, more dollars they were receiving from industry and also more conflicts being reported in their publications increased over time. And I think that would make sense. All of us need time to establish these relationships with pharma or with other industry companies. So I think it's logical that those things would increase with time.
Right. And I guess to kind of just put this in a perspective or to really help interpret this, what would you say is the main takeaway from these results? Or, how does this research really inform the field or impact drug development and handling these conflicts of interest? Where do you think this can make the largest impact?
Yeah, I think what the biggest impact, I think so a key finding from this paper was that, as we would expect that interactions, conflicts of interest would increase over time, but we actually found that that wasn't the only factor, that in terms of, so we found that the having more industry relationships correlated with having higher impact research and more publications. And that wasn't simply because of increased passage of time. So you would also imagine, as people get more senior, more established, their research program grows, their respect within the field grows, so they publish more and in more high impact places. But we found that it wasn't just that these investigators became more senior and that's why they were publishing more. There did seem to be an actual influence of having more relationships with industry. And so I think the big takeaway from that is that, I don't think we can have this clear sort of wall that, if you want to be a truly fully unbiased researcher and oncologist, that you can't take any money from industry whatsoever, and that all of this stuff is bad. I think that there is definitely there's a baby in a bathwater phenomenon going on here too. I think we have to learn to mitigate and manage these relationships because, the reality is, as time goes on, especially in oncology, the total number of funds that the federal government and other grant funding mechanisms have is quite small, really. The number of us that are going to have a grant in our careers is only going to go down over time because that pot of money is not really growing all that much. Whereas industry, of course, has a lot of money for R&D and everything. And so I think it's important to utilize that in a way that's beneficial for our patients. Because ultimately, I think there is an overlap of interest there where the companies do, of course, want to get their drugs to market, but that ultimately will also benefit our patients if found the right way.
Right. I think that's a really interesting point to make, and something, a perspective I haven't really looked at it in that manner. So that's really fascinating. So to conclude our conversation here, is there anything that we haven't talked about or I haven't asked you regarding this paper or the overall idea in general that you wanted to touch on?
Yeah, I think, one thing I do kind of wonder about, and we may do as a follow-up to this publication, is seeing sort of how these things change over time. This paper was a single snapshot of one time point, but I think it'd be really fascinating to see, to follow, these same researchers at these institutions in this study to see, in 5 years or 10 years, have those relationships grown further? Has that led to, more success as far as more publications and more impact on the field? I mean, that'd be really fascinating. And I would just emphasize, I think that there's still a lot more work I think that needs to be done to make sure that we are truly mitigating bias that comes from these things. I think a lot of us have a probably unrealistic view of ourselves that, having that dinner, getting coffee with a sales rep or something like that is not really influencing us at all. Of course, that's not true. I think they wouldn't do those things if they didn't have an impact, right? So I do think that I think we need to be more mindful of that on an ongoing basis, not just talk about it once or twice, but have it be something that comes top of mind, a few times a year, so that we are truly thinking introspectively about our practice and making sure that that really aligns with what's appropriate for patients and not being influenced by these other side things.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a great point to end on. Dr. Kama, thank you so much for your time and your insight into this paper. I really appreciate it.
Of course, yeah. Thanks for having me again.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com. And find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.